A Natural History of the Dead. It has always seemed to me that the war has been omitted as a field for the observations of the naturalist. We have charming and sound accounts of the flora and fauna of Patagonia by the late W.H. Hudson. The Reverend Gilbert White has written most interestingly of the hoopoe on its occasional and not at all common visits to Selborne. And Bishop Stanley has given us a valuable, although popular, familiar history of birds. Can we not hope to furnish the reader with a few rational and interesting facts about the dead? I hope so. When that persevering traveler, Mungo Park, was at one period of his course fainting in the vast wilderness of an African desert, naked and alone, considering his days as numbered and nothing appearing to remain for him to do but to lie down and die, a small moss flower of extraordinary beauty caught his eye. "Though the whole plant," says he, "was no larger than one of my fingers, I could not contemplate the delicate conformation of its roots, leaves, and capsules without admiration. Can that being, who planted, watered, and brought to perfection in this obscure part of the world a thing which appears of so small importance, look with unconcern upon the situation and suffering of creatures formed after his own image? Surely not. Reflections like these would not allow me to despair. I started up and, disregarding both hunger and fatigue, traveled forward, assured that relief was at hand, and I was not disappointed." With a disposition to wonder and adore in like manner, as Bishop Stanley says, can any branch of natural history be studied without increasing that faith, love, and hope which we also, every one of us, need in our journey through the wilderness of life? Let us, therefore, see what inspiration we may derive from the dead. In war, the dead are usually the male of the human species, although this does not hold true with animals, and I have frequently seen dead mares among the horses. An interesting aspect of war, too, is that it is only there that the naturalist has an opportunity to observe the dead of mules. In 20 years of observation in civil life, I have never seen a dead mule, and had begun to entertain doubts as to whether these animals were really mortal. On rare occasions, I had seen what I took to be dead mules, but on close approach, these always proved to be living creatures who seemed to be dead through their quality of complete repose. But in war, these animals succumb in much the same manner as the more common and less hardy horse. Most of those mules that I saw dead were along mountain roads or lying at the foot of steep declivities whence they had been pushed to rid the road of their encumbrance. They seemed a fitting enough sight in the mountains, where one was accustomed to their presence, and looked less incongruous there than they did later at Smyrna, where the Greeks broke the legs of all their baggage animals and pushed them off the quay into the shallow water to drown. The numbers of broken-legged mules and horses drowning in the shallow water called for a Goya to depict them, although, speaking literally, one can hardly say that they called for a Goya, since there has only been one Goya, long dead, and it is extremely doubtful if these animals, were they able to call, would call for pictorial representation of their plight, but more likely would, if they were articulate, call for someone to alleviate their condition. Regarding the sex of the dead, it is a fact that one becomes so accustomed to the sight of all the dead being men that the sight of a dead woman is quite shocking. I first saw inversion of the usual sex of the dead after the explosion of a munition factory which had been situated in the countryside near Milan, Italy. We drove to the scene of the disaster in trucks along poplar-shaded roads, bordered with ditches containing much minute animal life, which I could not clearly observe because of the great clouds of dust raised by the trucks. Arriving where the munition plant had been, some of us were put to patrolling about those large stocks of munitions which for some reason had not exploded, while others were put at extinguishing a fire which had gotten into the grass of an adjacent field, which task being concluded, we were ordered to search the immediate vicinity and surrounding field for bodies. We found and carried to an improvised mortuary a good number of these, And I must admit, frankly, the shock it was to find that these dead were women rather than men. In those days, women had not yet commenced to wear their hair cut short, as they did later for several years in Europe and America. And the most disturbing thing, perhaps, because it was the most unaccustomed, was the presence, and even more disturbing, the occasional absence of this long hair. I remember that after we had searched quite thoroughly for the complete dead, we collected fragments. Many of these were detached from a heavy barbed wire fence which had surrounded the position of the factory, and from the still existent portions of which we picked many of these detached bits, which illustrated only too well the tremendous energy of high explosive. Many fragments we found a considerable distance away in the fields, they being carried farther by their own weight. On our return to Milan, I recall one or two of us discussing the occurrence and agreeing that the quality of unreality and the fact that there were no wounded did much to rob the disaster of a horror which might have been much greater. Also, the fact that it had been so immediate, and that the dead were in consequence still as little unpleasant as possible to carry and deal with, made it quite removed from the usual battlefield experience. The pleasant, though dusty ride through the beautiful Lombard countryside also was a compensation for the unpleasantness of the duty, and on our return, while we exchanged impressions, we all agreed that it was indeed fortunate that the fire which broke out just before we arrived had been brought under control as rapidly as it had, and before it had attained any of the seemingly huge stocks of unexploded munitions. We agreed, too, that the picking up of the fragments had been an extraordinary business, it being amazing that the human body should be blown into pieces which exploded along no anatomical lines, but rather divided as capriciously as the fragmentation in the burst of a high explosive shell. A naturalist, to obtain accuracy of observation, may confine himself in his observations to one limited period, and I will take first that following the Austrian offensive of June 1918 in Italy as one in which the dead were present in their greatest numbers, a withdrawal having been forced, and an advance later made to recover the ground lost so that the positions after the battle were the same as before, except for the presence of the dead. Until the dead are buried, they change somewhat in appearance each day. The color change in Caucasian races is from white to yellow-green to black. If left long enough in the heat, the flesh comes to resemble coal tar, especially where it has been broken or torn, and it has quite a visible tar-like iridescence. The dead grow larger each day until sometimes they become quite too big for their uniforms, filling these until they seem blown tight enough to burst. The individual members may increase in girth to an unbelievable extent, and faces fill as taut and globular as balloons. The surprising thing, next to their progressive corpulence, is the amount of paper that is scattered about the dead. Their ultimate position, before there is any question of burial, depends on the location of the pockets in the uniform. In the Austrian army, these pockets were in the back of the breeches, and the dead, after a short time, all consequently lay on their faces, the two hip pockets pulled out and scattered around them in the grass, all those papers their pockets had contained. The heat, the flies, the indicative positions of the bodies in the grass, and the amount of paper scattered are the impressions one retains. The smell of a battlefield in hot weather one cannot recall. You can remember that there was such a smell, but nothing ever happens to you to bring it back. It is unlike the smell of a regiment, which may come to you suddenly while riding in the streetcar, and you will look across and see the man who has brought it to you. But the other thing is gone as completely as when you have been in love. You remember things that happened, but the sensation cannot be recalled. One wonders what the persevering traveler Mungo Park would have seen on a battlefield in hot weather to restore his confidence. There were always poppies in the wheat in the end of June and July, and the mulberry trees were in full leaf, and one could see the heat waves rise from the barrels of the guns where the sun struck them through the screens of leaves. The earth was turned bright yellow at the edge of holes where mustard gas shells had been, and the average broken house is finer to see than one that has been shelled. But few travelers would take a good full breath of that early summer air and have any such thoughts as Mungo Park about those formed in his own image. The first thing that you found about the dead was that, hit badly enough, they died like animals. Some quickly from a little wound you would not think would kill a rabbit. They died from little wounds, as rabbits die sometimes, from 3 or 4 small grains of shot that hardly seem to break the skin. Others would die like cats, a skull broken in and iron in the brain. They lie alive 2 days like cats that crawl into the coal bin with a bullet in the brain and will not die until you cut their heads off. Maybe cats do not die then. They say they have 9 lives. I do not know, but most men die like animals, not men. I'd never seen a natural death, so-called, and so I blamed it on the war, and like the persevering traveler, Mungo Park, knew that there was something else, that always absent something else. And then I saw one. The only natural death I've ever seen, outside of loss of blood, which isn't bad, was death from Spanish influenza. In this, you drown in mucus, choking. And how you know the patient's dead is, at the end, he turns to be a little child again, though with his manly force, and fills the sheets as full as any diaper with one vast, final, yellow cataract that flows and dribbles on after it is gone. So now I want to see the death of any self-called humanist, because a persevering traveler like Mungo Park or me lives on and maybe yet will live to see the actual death of members of this literary sect and watch the noble exits that they make. In my musings as a naturalist, it has occurred to me that while decorum is an excellent thing, some must be indecorous if the race is to be carried on, since the position prescribed for procreation is indecorous, highly indecorous, and it occurred to me that perhaps that is what these people are, or were, the children of decorous cohabitation. But regardless of how they started, I hope to see the finish of a few, and speculate how worms will try that long-preserved sterility, with their quaint pamphlets gone to bust and into footnotes all their lust. While it is perhaps legitimate to deal with these self-designated citizens in a natural history of the dead, even though the designation may mean nothing by the time this work is published, yet it is unfair to the other dead, who were not dead in their youth of choice, who own no magazines, many of whom had doubtless never even read a review, that one is seen in the hot weather with a half pint of maggots working where their mouths have been. It was not always hot weather for the dead. Much of the time it was the rain that washed them clean when they lay in it and made the earth soft when they were buried in it, and sometimes then kept on until the earth was mud and washed them out and you had to bury them again. Or in the winter in the mountains you had to put them in the snow, and when the snow melted in the spring, someone else had to bury them. They had beautiful burying grounds in the mountains. War in the mountains is the most beautiful of all war. And in one of them, at a place called Pacol, they buried a general who was shot through the head by a sniper. This is where those writers are mistaken who write books called Generals Die in Bed, because this general died in a trench dug in snow high in the mountains, wearing an alpini hat with an eagle feather in it and a hole in front you couldn't put your little finger in and a hole in back you could put your fist in, if it were a small fist, and if you wanted to put it there, and much blood in the snow. He was a damn fine general, and so was General von Baer, who commanded the Bavarian Alpencorps troops at the Battle of Caporetto, and was killed in his staff car by the Italian rearguard as he drove into Udine ahead of his troops. And the title of all such books should be Generals Usually Die in Bed, if we are to have any sort of accuracy in such things. In the mountains, too, sometimes, the snow fell on the dead outside the dressing station on the side that was protected by the mountain from any shelling. They carried them into a cave that had been dug into the mountainside before the earth froze. It was in this cave that a man whose head was broken as a flower pot may be broken, although it was all held together by membranes, and a skillfully applied bandage now soaked and hardened, with the structure of his brain disturbed by a piece of broken steel in it, lay a day, a night, and a day. The stretcher-bearers asked the doctor to go in and have a look at him. They saw him each time they made a trip, and even when they did not look at him, they heard him breathing. The doctor's eyes were red and the lids swollen, almost shut from tear gas. He looked at the man twice, once in daylight, once with a flashlight. That, too, would have made a good etching for Goya. The visit with the flashlight, I mean. After looking at him the second time, the doctor believed the stretcher-bearers when they said the soldier was still alive. "What do you want me to do about it?" he asked. There was nothing they wanted done. But after a while, they asked permission to carry him out and lay him with the badly wounded. "No, no, no," said the doctor, who was busy. "What's the matter? Are you afraid of him?"
"We don't like to hear him in there with the dead."
"Don't listen to him. If you take him out of there, you will have to carry him right back in."
"We wouldn't mind that, Captain Doctor."
"No," said the doctor. "No. Didn't you hear me say no?"
"Why don't you give him an overdose of morphine?"
asked an artillery officer who was waiting to have a wound in his arm dressed. "Do you think that is the only use I have for morphine? Would you like me to have to operate without the morphine? You have a pistol, go out and shoot him yourself."
"He's been shot already," said the officer. "If some of you doctors were shot, you'd be different."
"Thank you very much," said the doctor, waving a forceps in the air. "Thank you 1,000 times. What about these eyes?" He pointed the forceps at them. "How would you like these?"
"Tear gas. We call it lucky if it's a tear gas."
"Because you leave the line," said the doctor. "Because you come running here with your tear gas to be evacuated. You rub onions in your eyes."
"You are beside yourself. I do not notice your insult. You are crazy."
The stretcher-bearers came in.
"Captain Doctor,"
one of them said. "Get out of here," said the doctor. They went out.
"I will shoot the poor fellow,"
the artillery officer said.
"I am a humane man. I will not let him suffer."
"Shoot him then," said the doctor. "Shoot him. Assume the responsibility. I will make a report. Wounded shot by lieutenant of artillery in the first curing post. Shoot him. Go ahead, shoot him."
"You are not a human being."
"My business is to care for the wounded, not to kill them. That is for gentlemen of the artillery."
"Why don't you care for him, then?"
"I have done so. I have done all that can be done."
"Why don't you send him down on the cable railway?"
"Who are you to ask me questions, huh? Are you my superior officer? Are you in command of this dressing post? Do me the courtesy to answer."
The lieutenant of artillery said nothing. The others in the room were all soldiers, and there were no other officers present.
"Answer me," said the doctor, holding a needle up in his forceps. "Give me a response."
"Effa yourself,"
said the artillery officer.
"So,"
said the doctor.
"So, you said that.
All right. All right. We shall see."
"Effa yourself," he said. "Effa yourself. Effa your mother. Effa your sister."
The doctor tossed the saucer full of iodine in his face. As he came toward him, blinded, the lieutenant fumbled for his pistol. The doctor skipped quickly behind him, tripped him, and as he fell to the floor, kicked him several times and picked up the pistol in his rubber gloves. The lieutenant sat on the floor, holding his good hand to his eyes.
"I'll kill you," he said. "I'll kill you as soon as I can see."
"I am the boss," said the doctor. "All is forgiven since you know I am the boss. You cannot kill me because I have your pistol. Sergeant! Adjutant! Adjutant!" "The adjutant is at the cable railway," said the sergeant.
"Wipe out this officer's eyes with alcohol and the water. He has got iodine in them. Bring me the basin to wash my hands. I will take this officer next."
"You won't touch me."
"Hold him tight. He's a little delirious."
One of the stretcher-bearers came in.
"A captain doctor."
"What do you want?" "The man in the dead house. Get out of here."
"He's dead, Captain Doctor. I thought you would be glad to know."
"See, my poor lieutenant, we dispute about nothing. In time of war, we dispute about nothing."
"F you,"
said the lieutenant of artillery. He still could not see.
You have blinded me.
It is nothing, said the doctor. Your eyes will be all right. It is nothing, a dispute about nothing.
Ay,
suddenly screamed the lieutenant.
You have blinded me, you have blinded me.
Hold him tight, said the doctor. He is in much pain. Hold him very tight.